Hello, and welcome to Be Creator, Serious Influence, the podcast all about the creator economy. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Be Creator, formerly known as Blogosphere. Be Creator are the UK specialists in creator events. We run category-specific shows, such as the Beauty, Travel, and Health and Wellbeing Creator Show, which bring together brands, talent managers, and creators for a day of exhibitions, panels, presentations, and networking. And we also run the Be Creator Awards, our flagship event, which celebrates the best UK creators and creator marketing campaigns of the year. Last year's event had a reach of 179 million. If you would like to see some information about our events and how to get involved, head over to becreator.co.uk. Now, on to the show.
I'm Camilla Craven. These days I'm what's called a fractional CMO, which is essentially a fancy way of saying that I work in a CMO capacity for brands, but part-time. So I have a portfolio of 4 to 5 brands at any given time, helping for them to scale all their marketing activities and build their brand awareness.
And how did you end up here? What's been your career journey thus far? All the way back to the beginning. Take us back.
I started my career in PR and comms. It was at an agency called Halpin, which is still one of the leading comms agencies these days in London, but with global reach. And I mean, back then, I remember talking a lot about whether we even called what we did PR. It was at this sort of moving tides. It was the start of early social, start of early creator work, community. But effectively, what we did was build word of mouth for brands, and how we built word of mouth and who we chose as those audiences of advocates. It tended to be quite predominantly based in the press and media world, but the early inception of creator marketing was forming at that stage. So
what year were we in?
This is
2010. And what brands were you working on at Halpin?
So as an agency, we worked on brands that ranged from incubating brands from scratch, the likes of Trinity London. We brought a lot of brands to the UK from the US, like Lancer Skincare. We helped scale a lot of premium, prestige, luxury brands, the likes of Omravitsa, Organic Pharmacy. We worked on a lot of cult brands like Carmex, Lip Balm, through to helping some of the beauty giants, like the likes of Unilever, Avon, Molton Brown, with big repositioning work. So it was at the heart was how do we use community and comms to change either status quo or build a brand and build brand awareness. The agency had health and beauty team, lifestyle, fashion, retail, F&B. I headed up health and beauty by the end of my time there. So I'm a little bit of a health and beauty girl, but there's definitely been moments where I've popped out of it.
I was going to say, you said predominantly it was press and media, but then the world of creators started coming. What was your sort of first dealings with creators?
I mean, at the time it was bloggers. It was people who very much started to think like publishers and create these channels where they created incredible, engaging content and started building communities around them. But they were all doing it at the time as a side hustle. You know, most of them had full-time roles. I mean, there was certainly a lot of the early audience in that world were quite young, often at university, starting this, you know, as perhaps more of a hobby.
Yeah.
But then there was a huge amount of people that were doing it alongside their day jobs. And sometimes that credibility and clout came out of what they were doing for their day jobs. You know, there were some early beauty bloggers who worked in the industry and therefore had visibility of what was going on elsewhere and could start to, realize their voice had a lot of credibility in what they did and who they were and how they spoke.
Well, that's sort of how Sam and Nick Chapman and Tanya Burr, they were all on the counters, I think, at one point on the floor. So do you remember the first blogger or the first sort of campaign that you ran when you were at Halpin?
God, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. I'll tell you what I can remember really well, and is that the amazing Amelia Liana was one of my first interns when I worked at Halpin.
Wow.
And I remember, I mean, she'd already started doing the world of blogging and sort of at the time, that early influence through social. And I remember... Yeah.
Liana Beauty, I remember.
Exactly. And, you know, it's hugely influential even these days. And I remember saying to me, you know, Camilla, I'm going to go and give this a shot and do this full time. And I must admit, there was a little part of me that wondered whether this could be a full-time career for someone and what could be made. You know, I think we, even to this day, we don't all know what's around the corner and how this industry is going to go. And, you know, I had huge support for her and you could see the impact she was making, but must admit, I thought it was incredibly bold and brave to be able to pursue that as a full-time career. And any doubt I had, I was definitely the one in the wrong there.
Well, I think Goldman Sachs has just released an article, the creator economy could approach $500 billion by 2027, and that's Goldman Sachs.
Yeah. And social commerce is going to, I mean, it's going to take over, you know, traditional retail and wholesale as we know it today in terms of a retail channel.
So you leave Halpin, what happened?
I left Halpin to join Benefit Cosmetics, as at the time my role was senior PR and influencer manager. At that time, I felt, despite the incredible experience I'd had at Halpin, I worked on over 40 brands, as I said, at all stages of life cycle. But what I hadn't ever done was seen the brand side of things. And I felt to be really well-rounded. And as a marketeer, I not only wanted to see the in-house perception and world of how you build brands, but also to be able to start to have influence beyond just PR and comms. You know, there is only so much you can impact when you're you know, responsible for a channel and outsourced for that channel.
Was that always your plan, though, that you wanted to go into marketing? It was.
Yeah, I think it was. But I think mostly because at least the way I like to operate and my brain works is I don't think any part of marketing or even any part of brand, whether it's NPD, supply chain, operations, finance, should operate in silo. And I think to be the best at what you do, ultimately, it's how you knit all those channels together. And when we think about building brands commercially, you know, how do you build a brand? It's one customer. And so I don't think anyone should be thinking of it as, okay, what do we do in social media? And then what do we do over in PR? And what do we do over in influencer and creator world? What do we do over on the site? What do we do in CRM? You know, there's obviously elements of that's very channel specific, but I certainly feel at my best. And most importantly, think brands are at their best when you think of it collectively and cohesively.
How long do you think it's taken for creator to actually be part of that mix from the beginning and be taken seriously? I mean, Benefit Cosmetics, you were early doors in realizing the value of creator.
It's definitely taken, I mean, I've been doing this 13, 14 years now, and certainly only in very recent years have I seen creator marketing put at the very heart of a strategy to fuel brands. But it still shouldn't be at the heart of every brand's marketing strategy. I think there's definitely a lot of pressure right now to think it should, or to think suddenly a TikTok strategy should be sitting at the center of a strategy. You know, there's tendency at stakeholders and board level and investors to suddenly jump on, you know, not in a wrong way, but jump on the new trend that's helping to explode brands. But ultimately, it's what's right for your brand. But there was definitely many years where it felt like the world of creative marketing was an add-on. Or was the amplification rather than the heart. So I'm really pleased to say that's definitely changed.
When you mentioned, you know, creators sometimes should be at the heart, sometimes shouldn't. Obviously, each brand has its own story, but sort of broadly speaking, do you have any generalizations on where you think creator, what type of brand creator should be at the heart of and perhaps where it shouldn't be?
So I believe all brands should have community at the heart. And ultimately, the way you build brands of the future that are going to be here beyond the next couple of years, you know, there's so many brands that are scaling so fast, but have a limited tenure. You know, there's been a lot of brands in the media that we've all read about recently that unfortunately, you know, despite having their heyday and being case studies for success a couple of years ago, are no longer. I like to sort of approach marketing and think that we all should with how do we build a brand that will be here in 10, 20, 50, 100 years. And therefore, to do that, the two most important things to think about is how do you build loyalty for a brand and how do you build a brand that people want to associate themselves beyond just the product itself. So, you know, people are quite naturally fickle in the way we shop and the way that we think about what we purchase and what we, you know, the brands we spend our time with. But how can we build brands that actually are ones that you want to be part of beyond just in the moment you're thinking about refilling said product or buying something that you haven't already got. And so when you think about the way I at least approach how you build that loyalty and that sticky factor, it's through the community. And when I talk about community, that's not just the world of customers or your employees, but it's the world of those around you that have influence. It's, you know, it's everyone from the press to the world of creators that can vary from all types of sectors, all sizes, all scale. And therefore, I do think an element of creative marketing should be at the heart of what every brand does. But where I think the variety comes in, you know, one brand, it might be suited to have a creator be the actual face of the brand and the voice of the brand and featuring in campaigns and, you know, being that lead narrative. Whereas for other brands, it's the amplification of the broader brand. You know, they would never have a creator sitting as the face of or the lead voice or the lead message, but certainly using the world of creators to tell that story and to amplify what you're doing. So I think that's where the variety happens.
I mean, I completely agree with the building of the brand and how it's for the future and how you do that. Do you think that perhaps some brands have got lost in performance marketing and aren't thinking about the future and they're just looking at the quick returns and aren't really building brand and just looking at conversions?
Yeah, I mean, hugely. And I think, you know, what's been changing in the world of Meta and their algorithms and, you know, even the world of TikTok going from a very organic platform to obviously naturally being very driven by media investment. You used to be able to, and I'm talking just a couple of years ago, build a brand very successfully just through a growth channel. And it comes back to my point I think I made earlier, which is, ultimately, every business has a slightly different objective. Some are very much got a short-term view and lens on what they're trying to do. They you know, they want to build quick, build fast, own the category, and then sell the brand on. And you know, others have the long game. And ultimately, I believe even if you've got a long game or a short game, ultimately the value of your brand will be in what you've built for the future. So to be able to focus on that, and I think you've got to. Again, a growth channel mix and a growth strategy is only as good as the sum of the parts. And so how that fits into brand and how that fits into the world of earned and how that fits into the world of owned. And it, you know, it's never a perfect science to how you do that. And I think one of the biggest challenges for brands right now is how to structure it internally and how to resource for it. Because, you know, I work with businesses that are very lean and nimble and small, and that has some benefits and some disadvantages. But then I've also worked with clients and have worked in places that have huge teams where you start to become very siloed. And how do you actually help the teams to think about campaigns in a very integrated way so that you don't double up on what you're doing, so you can be really efficient on the output so that one channel fuels the other rather than having to rely on its own channel for growth. Growth marketing, I think, is where its success comes right now, is when you have that earned, owned and paid strategy all linked into one. It's all, you know, it has elements which it dials up and dials down depending on the channel, but ultimately it's all stitched together.
I'm going to just take us back to Benefit now. Early adopter really of the creators, what was your experience like there and how did you work with creators? What did your role entail?
Gosh, I loved that those was Benefit really was such an early adopter, as you say, and they were really brave and bold in the way they approached it. At the time, creators, or at the time we didn't even call them creators, you know, it was influencers, bloggers, yep, whatever it was at the time. Brands were very driven by an obsession of scale and size of said influencer. You know, they were all of a sudden understanding the you know, appreciating the value of them, but it was very much running after the ones which had the biggest reach and the biggest amount of followers and the most famous. And really what we tried to pioneer at Benefit, and I'm still so adamantly believe this is the right approach, is about building the right community of voices. And it doesn't matter what the size of them are. Obviously, someone with huge reach and huge engagement will equal perhaps, you know, of course, bigger brand awareness in a quicker way. But we had a program at Benefit. It was called Friends with Benefit. It was playing on, obviously, Friends with Benefits. And it was essentially an early form of a nano micro-influencer community base. It was a channel and a community where we could reward and incentivize community relationships and engagement as a brand. We did a huge amount of seeding and gifting of various people. We did huge eventing programs around the country. And we really, ultimately, Benefit was about, I mean, the tagline at the time, it was and still is, laughter is the best cosmetic. And ultimately what we tried to do is create a world where people felt comfortable with us and had fun with us. And all of a sudden it wasn't a huge focus on, we still obviously, you know, wanted people to say this mascara is the best in the world, this bronzer, this whatever product it might be. But it was actually going back to my point earlier about how you build brands and that stickiness. I want to actually be friends with this brand and I want to hang out with this brand and I want to tell you about this brand as well. And then the second strategy was, how do we build brand experience? You know, Benefit have always been the pioneers of brand experience and still are to this day. But you'll remember the likes of, they had a roller lash bar and sort of cafe. We did something called the Good Ship Benefit, which was a 4-month pop-up on the Thames. It was a ship. We made restaurants themed into products. We had a yoga deck. We had secret cinema running throughout the summer. We had, you know, onboard beauty services. But ultimately what we were building is a way for creators and customers and our own makeup artists and people that work for the business to come and engage with the brand and create like those moments and touch points.
How important was the brand experience part of the mix in terms of what that gave back? And how do you measure experience event?
Yeah, I mean, it was hugely important. It was a big part of the pillar, and it was how we built all of our marketing was rooted in brand experience. How we measured it varied from everything from how many people attended to how many times they came back, because attending once, but you know, that loyalty and that repetition, dwell time, you know, social narrative that came off the back of that, both from customers as well as those that were helping us to promote it organically or in other ways, share a voice across all of those channels, you know, NPS sentiment across those that were part of our world. And ultimately, you know, sales do come into that. You know, you can't, you know, there's some initiatives we do in the world of brand building and brand marketing, which the first objective is not to drive sales, but ultimately there has to be a commercial impetus to actually do anything. Otherwise, what are we doing? You know, it might not be an immediate payback, but certainly at the time we were launching Benefit's first brow collection, and you know, the proof was in the pudding in terms of we launched and we became the number one brow range within a couple of weeks of launch. And, you know, it was partly due to the broader marketing activity that went alongside it. But that integrated campaign of the Good Ship Benefit that was there to celebrate brows, it was a huge pillar of that approach.
I still use Benefit Brow.
They're great. And it gives people loyalty, right? Because, you know, ultimately you can buy a brow product from anywhere.
Yeah.
But if you start to build a brand that people want to be part of and love being around it, you know, we talk about a lot of brands want to own the makeup bag and then they want to own the vanity table, but actually my kind of approach is, how do we own just their, like, the conversations they have with their friends? How do we own the way they think about their day?
How did you go about at Benefit working out what the sort of lifetime value of the customer was, and is that taken into consideration? You know, mentioned when you start things, it's not necessarily the sell, which is the first thing, it's those touch points. What would you, if you were to describe, when you're visualising a customer, what the journey of an average customer is from introduction to sell? I think somebody was telling me it was sort of like 7 or touch points.
I mean, it takes, yeah, on average, it takes about 7 touch points to even convert a customer. I mean, it depends what sector you're in. You know, sometimes if you're in luxury jewellery, you could be talking about 15 touch points between, you know, their research and endorsement reviews and, you know, ways that they take to convert. But then also in the world of social commerce we have right now, there's a lot of very impulse purchasing goes on where there's frankly just one touch point on Instagram while you're scrolling and watching TV. You weren't planning on buying something and all of a sudden you get attacked, you know, you sort of approach in the right way. But ultimately, developing lifetime value for a customer, it's the same theory of how you do that for every brand, but it will obviously change depending on what the brand is, what your average order value is, what your you know, your loyal cohorts are, and their you know, the average retention and repeat purchasing you have of them. So you can start to build a profile of what would the perfect customer look like and what would that lifetime value look like, and then you can start to work back of, okay, well, you know, what is the CAC on that first touch point? How do we have that return on investment be across that lifetime, so it's not always worrying about that first touch point?
I've been served quite a few ads for a company called Merwave, which is, they've done it very well. It's do you think that you might have wavy hair? And then they have lots of user generated content and the journey. And so I've seen that a lot of times, told my sister. My sister then went and bought it. Now I've tried her set and now I'll buy it. So it's interesting to see the...
Well, it's funny, actually, what you've said there is one of the things I love the most about the world of advocacy is, you know, sometimes your most valuable advocates are people that have never actually bought your brand. And to me, going back to that customer segments, in every strategy I try to build with clients, or brands when I'm working in-house, is thinking about that world. They're almost, they're your social advocates, I think it's the best way to describe them. You know, they're people that fangirl after you, they're the ones that follow you on social, they're the ones that tell their friends about them, but they might have never actually bought into the brand. And how incredible to have an audience that go around preaching about you before they've even purchased. So, but then more importantly, how can you help convert them? Like, are they not coming into the brand because they can't afford it, because it's a price point? Or is it just not at a time in their life when they're ready for it yet? You know, and ultimately, how do you also say thank you and reward and appreciate that type of behaviour as well?
And I think with creators as well, the fact that, you know, my sister's like, yeah, the product's really good. It's like, okay, well, I'm definitely going to buy it now. But if it's a creator, it's not just, you know, a billboard that looks, someone's got really nice hair, is very different to a creator that you know. It's that, so it sort of expedites the process of those touch points with creator work. Would you agree?
Absolutely. But then it comes back to what we were talking about, which is multi-touch points that's always needed. You know, there's of course always going to be an instance where you see a creator talk about something and that's enough for you to buy it. But it might be that that's what piques your interest to start with. And then you might ask some friends to see what they recommend. And then you might do a bit of Google research and see what the publishers are saying and look at Trustpilot. You might then, you know, sign up to their newsletter and wait to get a promotion. You know, ultimately, sometimes the way people come into the funnel obviously happens at all different touch points. And it's rare that one channel is enough to push someone over the line. And so, again, thinking about how do you have that broader narrative and all those touch points working together.
When do you leave Benefit and then where do you go?
I left Benefit because Charlotte Tilbury came knocking and I didn't feel finished with Benefit. It was the most amazing, incredible year. And the potential for what we could do there was huge. And I felt we were just...
What year was this?
2015.
2015. So when was the... the Benefit Maldives trip, was that 16?
Quite a long time after I left. Yeah. About 2 years after I left, at least, possibly. At Benefit, we did one trip. We did, but it wasn't a trip just for the trip's sake. We the global launch of Browse was launched in Las Vegas. And for a few reasons, well, the whole Brow range was themed around magic.
Right.
And the whole concept was around magic and sort of magically transforming brows. And we worked with an incredible magician that was based in Las Vegas. And it was the global launch. So all markets, I think it was 40, 50 markets, flew people in. And that was mostly from a cost efficiency perspective. You know, it's really hard for brands, particularly when you're building in many markets, to have a small market in the Netherlands or in Thailand to be able to pull off their own events and their own trips and their own budget. So whilst flight costs are very expensive and obviously you know, the impact of sustainability and carbon footprint, for many brands it makes sense sometimes to host a global moment. So I wouldn't put that in the camp of the more traditional content trips that have happened since. But we certainly were doing trips at the time. The downside of that is you just can't take many people because cost is prohibitive when it comes to investment. But certainly going back to that rich storytelling, how better way to tell a brand story than to immerse them in something.
We're seeing the rising creator weeks as well. You've got Meta Creator Week, Amazon just did theirs in Berlin.
Exactly. So I'm not really a super fan of doing in fact, I've never done, other than the trips, that one I just mentioned, expensive storytelling brand immersion trips for a brand. I mean, I've been very lucky, the brands I've worked for, I don't think you have to elaborately create stories to be able to bring people in that world. I think there's sometimes those trips, no disrespect to some of those brands, but almost feel the need to overcompensate for perhaps something missing in other areas by creating this most elaborate, amazing experience that makes people fall in love with the brand. I think if you've got the right product with itself and you've got the right relationships and you create something, it doesn't have to be over the top and it doesn't have to be outlandish. But, you know, that world of trips has always existed in PR. It's been there for many years and, you know, it's not going to go away.
Then you move on to Charlotte Tilbury, which... is just some of the best products, isn't it?
Aren't they the best? When Charlotte Tilbury approached me for the role, I knew about them and was obsessed with what they were up to. They'd already started disrupting the market quite aggressively. But a lot of my friends and even peers in the industry sort of said to me, why are you leaving the number one makeup brand in the world to go to one that's just launched, you've never really heard, no one's really heard of? And, you know, I think where I most gets most excited is when you build something. And whilst Benefit was incredible to build and onto what existed, it's not often you get an opportunity to build something from bottom up. And you know, I came to Charlotte Tilbury almost, so I joined them in January 2016. Honestly, the years have all blended. They were a couple of years into their journey. They'd launched in the US, they'd launched in Canada. They'd certainly built a lot of credibility for what they were doing and started to be very disruptive. You know, they launched into Selfridges and broke every record that ever existed. But what I was, I went in there as global head of PR, I think was my title when I joined. And what I was most excited about was having a brand that had a creator or someone of influence at the helm as a founder, but wasn't in a traditional, you know, Charlotte had 20, 30 years of experience being the world's number one makeup artist and all of the grit and hustle that had come with that and the shows she'd done and the covers she'd done and the celebrities she'd work with. But her influence didn't come from a social space natively. Mm. And so I was quite excited about the opportunity about how do you take, how do you use someone like that and work with a brand that's named after them, but ultimately build a huge community around them of people that will be aspire to be part of it. Because I think when you have a founder, it can be easy by mistake to you know, isolate others as well, because it's all about, you know, the tendency is not to be all about them, but naturally this is a brand that is based on one person's expertise. And what I was most excited about at Charlotte Tilbury was the world of influence of our own artistry. How could we build, you know, Charlotte's only one person, so how I couldn't scale her quick enough. I couldn't get her on enough planes around the world. I couldn't.
But the Charlotte Tilbury look is, you know, my sister came to Christmas, I don't know, Christmas before last Christmas, and looked at her. First thing I was like, you've got Charlotte Tilbury face. And she'd been off and like laid down about £600 on every single Charlotte Tilbury product. It's like, you look amazing. But you can see that's a Charlotte Tilbury.
You know, I obviously looked after the press side, but also influencer and advocacy side. And to what an opportunity to think about how do we build influence, use Charlotte where we need to. And but she's ultimately only one person with so many hours in the day. And we were launching, I think we did something like 20 countries in my 4 years there. But how do we start to think about other voices and other creators that can start to weave into that world? You know, and the brand was very much, you know, it was makeup and red carpet secrets, red carpet, makeup and skincare secrets. And therefore the world of creators and people around us, makeup artists, influencers, celebrities, creators, you know, other female entrepreneurs was really a big part of that narrative of how do we tell that brand story of that red carpet moment to them. So it became a sort of natural synergy to be able to do that.
How important was gifting at Charlotte Tilbury? Remember at that, you know, during those years, it's where the beauty market within the creator economy, people are expecting, you know, payment and that it had moved. But with Charlotte Tilbury, the products were just known to be so good that I think it was Gio saying, you know, trying to pay people, but people wanted to do stuff for free because the products were so good to get the, you know, first hands on it.
I mean, me and the team worked and all our agency partners worked so hard. I've never known a harder working group. It definitely didn't come easy. And I think the outside world was, it looked like it was easy for us because people love that brand. But gifting was a huge part of everything we did. But it was very considered gifting. It wasn't just blanket this, blanket that. It was what, like, you know, even going back to you talking about the look of your sister, like, what look are you? And starting to build stories around that. But we were very fortunate that, you know, gifting was certainly a very powerful tool for us. And then we did a lot of, you know, this was at the time when social media, you know, everyone had, even if you were, say, a journalist where your traditional avenue of authority was in your pages or on your website, they started to have their own individual channels where they wanted to share content and, you know, be an individual voice. And so we did at the time, that was where creative mailers became a huge part of the world of creator relationship building. And so we invested a lot of time into building mini brand experiences in a box that you received that could tell the story. And obviously we've all moved on again from that world because it started to get a little bit excessive. And, you know, ultimately, again, going back, I think the product should do a lot of the talking, and therefore do you need to have a huge you know, unboxing experience that goes with that. But in those early years of Charlotte Tilbury, that was very important. And then obviously I was there for COVID as well. And so when physical experiences and moments became not an option for us and people couldn't spend time with Charlotte in person, you know, how did we create those digital moments? And that's actually when a lot of the paid work did start with Charlotte Tilbury. But we worked a lot with, I had an amazing program called Charlotte's Magic Makeup Stars, which still exists to this day, which is effectively like an amplified affiliate program for, and a community management and loyalty program for makeup artists, experts, influencers of all sizes and creators, of how do we suddenly turn everyone into equivalent of Avon ladies in the air, yeah, to be able to start promoting a brand and help us. You know, how do we take 800 of our own makeup artists who were furloughed or, you know, whatever was going on during COVID, and we could actually turn them into mini talent, not even mini talent, very successful talent, and give them that platform to have authority and to own their voice.
And be able to support themselves when things are going down.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned you'd never sort of met a harder working team, you know, from the outside, everything, you know, as it often does. It's like, wow, it's just so amazing. Were there times, you know, where it was overwhelming or where things weren't
of course.
Going?
Building anything from the bottom is always tough.
What challenges do you remember?
I think, honestly, the biggest challenge, so when I joined, my team was two people, and when I left, there was about 35 of us globally and we had about 16 agencies working with us. Honestly, the biggest challenge we always had was time and resources. You know, we were starting to become very popular and very loved, but actually management of that inbound and management of the proactive outreach was a challenge in itself. You know, how did we weren't, what was beautiful about Charlotte Tilbury versus a lot of the luxury brands, for a long time, a lot of the luxury brands felt someone was on brand or off brand for them and they were quite exclusive with how they worked. Charlotte was so inclusive and, you know, so empowering. And whilst obviously it's a luxurious and quite glamorous vibe that the brand, you know, puts out, ultimately it's how do you want to feel and how do you want to look? And so it meant that basically no one was off brand for us. So the world of how we juggled everyone that wanted to be part of it, it sounds like a bad problem to have, but honestly that was the biggest challenge for my team, which was sheer management. And at the time a lot of tools didn't exist to be able to do, you know, these days there's incredible technology that's starting to come out every day improving of how to help us do our job, but everything from identification to monitoring to how you fulfill orders to how we manage relationships, it was super manual. And we were launching a lot of products in a lot of countries all at once. And so, and we had big ambitions, you know, Charlotte had big dreams. Yeah. And so to make that happen, it was one of the most rewarding chapters of my life, but it was also, you know, one of the most challenging, and I do it all over again, but you don't become a number one brand in 5 or 6 years by sitting like twiddling your thumbs, you know, and we had our opportunity to own it. And I mean, I've left, I'm almost 3 years out. October this year, I'll be 3 years out.
So when did it got bought? But when was that during your time?
Yes, that was Pooj came in as a majority investor. It wasn't a full acquisition.
Yeah.
Summer of 2019? 2020 must have been.
Was it 2020?
Yeah, COVID. It was the first COVID year. Honestly, I don't run my life in years. They will blur in the actual numbers, but I think it was 2020. Since I've left, what they've achieved is mind-blowing. Like, I saw some statistics the other day that I think it was Tracker had shared in terms of the rankings we'd grown during my time there. You know, but what they've now since achieved is just remarkable.
You mentioned that when you were there were the 16 agencies, and then during COVID, that is when the paid stuff started to grow. So in terms of your dealings from a brand perspective with agencies and also talent agencies, who were you sort of, are you talking like the main ad agencies that you were working with? Then did you have any sort of contracts or retainers with influencer marketing specific agencies? And how did you find, you know, over the years, you'll have dealt with many talent managers. These are lots of different questions, but so maybe the first, did you have any retainers with influencer marketing agencies?
No was the answer at the time. We, even though we started doing paid partnerships at the time, and it was partly led by COVID, partly led for just change of strategy, but also partly led by we then had the investment start playing with it. You know, even I think a lot of people look at brands and think, gosh, they're doing so well and so successful, therefore they must be just have so much money. But if you were trying to run a profitable business, you know, the amount of investment that's unlocked doesn't always equal that. So we weren't doing enough work at the time to justify. We had no agencies supporting us. We did it all in-house through my team, and we worked with the digital marketing team as well, supported on some projects. We didn't at the time have anyone on long-term contracts. We basically were doing a lot of testing yeah. and learning and optimizing. I mean, as I said, we worked a lot through the affiliate model, so that was happening all the time and always had. And we were looking at ways we could incentivize through different thresholds, almost like a royalty model, almost within some of those projects. But obviously, the world of talent management has changed over the years. For many years, you had your direct relationship with the creator, and you only ever worked with their manager or their agent once it became a paid deal, whereas a lot of those managers actually and agents now manage the organic relationships on behalf of creators with brands, which I think part of me, I totally understand why it happens. You know, these people are individuals. They've only got so many hours in a day. I think it makes it harder for some brands to cut through, because ultimately you can only build... I'm a big believer in relationships as the foundations of everything we do. And how can you build a relationship when you're actually talking to the person directly and you're not seeing them directly? But the world of talent managers and agents is a huge part of the world of what I do and my peers do. And I think of going back to that sphere of influence of who's important for a brand, I would treat a talent manager and an agent as important to me as the creator itself, because they're my gateway and they're my... access. And their influence and what they're telling their friends is as important to me as their talent they manage.
Mm. What do you think make the good traits of a talent manager?
I think the best trait, and I'm going to say I don't see it as much as I'd love to, is really helping to co-create some ideas that would be brilliant for both brand and talent. I think there's a tendency to sort of say, what is it you're looking for? And you come with a baked idea. Whereas I'd love to see more of creators. They're the ones that know their audience the best, but ultimately, and so you could give them a very loose brief that ultimately they could run with and make something super unique. So I think that's the main thing that I'd be looking for.
Yeah.
And I think the second piece is there's still some tendency to pick and choose what data you share when you want to share it.
Yeah,
I think there could still be more transparency. I think ultimately, influencer paid partnerships has to be a form of growth marketing, and therefore there has to be, a decent ROAS and way of calculating that CAC. And therefore, the number one way you can do that is by understanding their performance, past performance, and how things have worked with them. And there's definitely still an element of kind of a dark hole when it comes to that kind of world.
Mm. What return on investment, what were the metrics that you wanted to see from talent managers when you were working on things like that?
I mean, there's the obvious when it comes to more the organic side and the brand awareness side is the reach of an engagement rate across their the content they're creating. There's no point just looking at their follower numbers. It's who actually engages with the content. These days there's also how do you kind of, especially in the world of TikTok, almost get that virality behind that content as well. It's obviously conversion, click-through rate, conversion to actual sales, that's important. I mean, as I said, it depends what you're looking for from that specific brief. If you're looking to really deliver a particular narrative and a piece of, a brand message and a piece of content that needs to be used in a certain way, that's a very different need to our brief is we need to sell X amount of this lipstick and let's work backwards on how we make that work.
So you leave Charlotte Tilbury and yes. Now you're... 4 to 5 max that you work with across in your fractional CMO capacity now?
Yeah, I had two stints in between this chapter and that, which was I was a brand comms director at Vashi, the jewellery brand, and yeah. Then I was brand and marketing director at Facegym. But yes, I've been doing Fractional World since last October.
Say I'm a beauty brand and I'm growing, we're doing a bit of influence marketing in-house. When is the time, would you say, if at all, that I move from an in-house influence marketing department to outsourcing?
I am always most favour the in-house model because I think ultimately it comes down to relationships, and it's really a relationship is just so much stronger when it's directly from the brand versus someone on your behalf. That being said, in-house talent is expensive, it's a big resource, it's a big overhead, it's you know, it's certainly got a risk that comes to it when brands are testing channels. So the role of agency is super important to, I think you can test and learn in that channel before you start investing in it full time. I think, though, what I do see is a lot of brands feeling like they need to jump into a huge program overnight. My biggest advice is, yes, you should all be playing in the creator space, but you don't have to start with hundreds of thousands of people. Yeah. This could start with 5, 10, 15, 20. Start working out what works, you're testing and learning. So I think there's that natural sort of feeling of needing to rush it. But in all honesty, the in-house agency model, it's very different. Like, I've got, of all my clients right now, everyone does it in a slightly different way, and it works well for each of them. So it just depends what countries you're operating in, do you have a wholesale model as well as D2C? How big is the world of influence that can in theory be powerful to you? Are you playing in paid or only in organic? You know, all of those conversations come into how do you build org structure. And actually, a lot of what I do in the briefs I work with clients these days is a lot of org design and resource development and processes and tools and basically how to set them up for success. Mm. Because ultimately, I think I said this in the very first minute we were on, like the biggest challenge we've got is time and people. That's every business's number one challenge. And so getting that right and tools to help optimize that and be efficient, but also not have death by data because you're so sucked in all of that is critical. But you're never going to have, there's no one size fits all approach.
My final question for you, what are your predictions for the creator space over the next 18 months and creator marketing?
What are my predictions? I think I say every day is a school day, and even though I've been doing this for a long time, there's a lot I just have no, like, I can't even dream of probably what's around the corner. I think there's a few things. I think the world of AI is going to have a huge impact into the space. I think that I do think the role of SaaS and tools and tech to be able to fuel what we do and make things more efficient and optimize has to be a trend that's coming.
Do you have a favorite? I know you mentioned that tools have got better.
I have lots that I really admire. No one ticks every single box I'm looking for.
Yeah.
In fact, if I had time or if I ever was to create a company.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you that. With all of your expertise and liking to build stuff from the ground up, would you ever consider launching your own beauty brand?
Never say never, but I don't think so. I love bringing people's visions to life. And I get a lot of, and in fact, the world right now of getting to work with a number of different brands at different life cycles, different stages, I've never felt more sort of energized.
So I think
there's something to be said for that. But so going back to the tools, there's many I think are incredible. I think the likes of Jewel in advocacy, I think the likes of Grin, I think, you know, there's so many players that are doing very interesting things, but no one's ticking every box. So I'd love that to be something that's solved, and also affordable tools and tech, because right now a lot of the young brands are priced out of that world, sadly.
Yeah.
I think as well, predictions, I think we'll think about, I see this more and more luckily happening, but the understanding of the role of customer advocacy playing more in employee advocacy. I think we get very obsessed with people who have like more significant influence, but actually I would say advocacy starts at home. And how do you take your own existing customer base and your community base to actually fuel the creator economy? And obviously social commerce in general, just where that's going is going to be the biggest trend of the next months and years.
A big thanks to Camilla for coming on the show.